A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. The second half of Chapter 4, The State of Degradation to Which Woman is Reduced by Various Causes. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. I am convinced that the heart, as well as the understanding, is opened by cultivation, and also by strengthening the organs, though that is less obvious. I am not talking of momentary flashes of sensibility, but of durable affections, and in the education of both sexes it may be that the most difficult task is to adjust the instruction in such a way that the understanding and the affections are in a proper balance, so that the understanding is not narrowed, while the heart is warmed by the generous juices of spring, or engaged in investigations that are remote from life, thereby drying up the feelings. When women receive a careful education, they come out of it either as fine ladies, brimful of sensibility, and teeming with capricious fancies, or as mere notable women, i.e. capable and industrious homemakers. The latter are often friendly, honest creatures, and have a shrewd kind of good sense joined with worldly prudence, a combination that often makes them more useful members of society than the fine, sentimental lady, though they don't possess any greatness of mind or of taste. The intellectual world is shut against them. Take them out of their family or neighbourhood, and they come to a halt, finding nothing for their minds to do, for they have never tried to enjoy the satisfaction that literature provides. Often they have despised it. The sentiments and taste of more cultivated minds appear ridiculous, even in those whom chance and family connections have led them to love, but in mere acquaintances they think it all affectation. If a man of sense loves a woman like that, it can only be on account of her sex, and if he respects her, it is because she is a trusty servant. To preserve his own peace, he lets her scold the servants, and go to church in clothes made of the very best materials. A man with only her level of understanding would probably not suit her so well, because he might wish to encroach on her territory, and manage some domestic concerns himself. Yet women, whose minds are not enlarged by cultivation, or in whom the natural selfishness of sensibility hasn't been expanded by reflection, are very unfit to manage a family, because they always stretch their power and use tyranny to maintain a superiority that rests on nothing but the arbitrary distinction of fortune. The evil is sometimes more serious than that, and domestic servants are deprived of innocent pleasures and made to work beyond their strength in order to enable the notable woman to keep a better table and outshine her neighbours in finery and parade. If she attends to her children, it is usually to dress them expensively, and whether she does this out of vanity or out of fondness for the children, it is pernicious either way. Many women of this sort pass their days, or at least their evenings, discontentedly. Their husbands acknowledge that they are good managers and chaste wives, but they leave home to seek more agreeable and stimulating society. And the patient drudge, who fulfills her task like a blind horse in a mill, is defrauded of her just reward, for the wages due to her are the caresses of her husband, and women who have so few resources in themselves don't patiently bear being deprived of a natural right in this way. A fine lady, on the other hand, has been taught to look down with contempt on common vulgar employments of life, though she is in no position to be so haughty, because the only accomplishments she has been motivated to acquire are ones with next to no intellectual content, for even bodily accomplishments can't be acquired with any precision unless the understanding has been strengthened by exercise. Without a foundation of principles, taste is superficial, and grace must arise from something deeper than imitation. These women are often amiable, and their hearts are more sensitive to general benevolence, more alive to the feelings that civilize life, than the sturdy family drudge. But because they are deficient in reflection and self-government, they only inspire love, and for as long as they have any hold on their husband's affections, it is as their mistress's. These women are the fair defects in nature, the women who seem to be created not to enjoy the fellowship of man, but to save him from sinking to the merely animal level by rubbing off the rough angles of his character, and to give some dignity to the appetite that draws man to them by playful teasing. Gracious Creator of the whole human race, have you created such a being as woman, who can trace your wisdom in your works, and feel that you alone are by your nature exalted above her, for no better purpose than this? Can she believe that she was made only to submit to man, who is her equal, a being sent into the world to acquire virtue, as she was? Can she consent to be wholly occupied in pleasing him, merely to adorn the earth when her soul is capable of rising to you? And can she passively depend on man for reason, when she ought to climb the difficult slopes of knowledge alongside him? To fulfil domestic duties, one needs a serious kind of perseverance that requires a firmer support than emotions can give, however lively and true to nature they are. Order is the soul of virtue. To give an example of it, a person has to adopt some austerity of behaviour, and this can hardly be expected from a being who, from his or her infancy, has been made the weathercock of his or her own sensations. Whoever rationally means to be useful must have a plan of conduct, and in performing the simplest duty, we are often obliged to act against the present impulse of tenderness or compassion. Severity is often the clearest proof of affection, and the lack of this power over the feelings, and of the dignified affection that makes a person prefer the future good of the beloved object to a present gratification, is the reason why so many fond mothers spoil their children. Which is more damaging, negligence or indulgence? I am inclined to answer indulgence. Mankind seem to agree that children should be left under the management of women during their childhood. Judging by what I have seen, women of sensibility, women in whom feelings are uppermost, are the least fit for this task, because they are bound to be carried away by their feelings and spoil a child's temperament. The management of the temperament, the first and most important branch of education, requires the sober, steady eye of reason, so as to form and stick with a plan of conduct that is equally distant from tyranny and indulgence. Yet these are the extremes that people of sensibility fall into, first on one side, then on the other, always shooting beyond the mark. These thoughts, and the further development of them that I have gone through, lead me to conclude that a person of genius is the least suitable person to be employed in education, whether public or private. Minds of this rare species see things too much in masses, and seldom if ever have a good temperament. The habitual cheerfulness that we call good humour is perhaps as seldom united with great mental powers as it is with strong feelings. And people who admiringly follow the flights of genius, or with cooler approval drink in the instruction elaborately prepared for them by a profound thinker, ought not to be upset if they find the former bad-tempered and the latter gloomy, because liveliness of imagination and a tenacious comprehension of mind are hardly compatible with the smooth politeness which leads a man at least to bend to the opinions and prejudices of others, instead of roughly confronting them. When we are thinking about education or manners, minds of a superior class can be left to take care of themselves. It is the moderately able multitude who need instruction, and are at risk because they take on the tone of the atmosphere that surrounds them. This body of men and women should be respected, and should not have their sensations heightened in the hotbed of luxurious idleness at the expense of their understanding. For unless there's a ballast of understanding, they will never become virtuous or free. Why won't they be free? Because an aristocracy based on property or on solid talents will always overwhelm the alternately timid and ferocious slaves of feeling. I now switch to look at our topic from a different angle. Men have used countless arguments in support of morally and physically degrading the female sex. The arguments are brought forward with a show of reason, because they are supposed to be derived from nature, I must discuss a few of them. The female understanding has often been spoken of, with contempt, as reaching maturity sooner than the male. I shan't answer this argument by mentioning the early proofs of reason, and indeed genius, in Cowley, Milton, Pope, and many others. I merely appeal to experience to decide whether young men, who are early introduced into company, don't acquire the same precocity. Some natural scientists have said that men don't attain their full growth and strength until 30, whereas women reach maturity by 20. I think they are reasoning on false premises, having been led astray by the male prejudice that regards beauty as the perfection of woman, taking beauty in the everyday sense in which it refers only to features and complexion, while male beauty is regarded as having some connection with the mind. Strength of body, and the facial character that shows maturity and moral strength, is something that women don't acquire before 30 any more than men do. The artless little tricks of children are indeed particularly pleasing and attractive, but when the pretty freshness of youth has worn off, these artless graces become careful poses, and they disgust every person of taste. In the faces of girls, we look only for vivacity and bashful modesty, but when the springtide of life is over, we look for a more sober sense in the face, and for traces of passion instead of the dimples of animal spirits. We expect to see individuality of character, which is the only thing that can fasten the affections. We then want to converse, not to fondle, to give scope to our imaginations, as well as to the sensations of our hearts. The French, who admit more mind into their notions of beauty, give the preference to women of 30. This means that they allow women to be in their most perfect state when vivacity gives way to reason, and to the majestic seriousness of character which signifies maturity. Between 20 and 30, the solid parts of the body become denser, and the flexible muscles grow more rigid, giving character to the face, i.e., they trace the operations of the mind with the iron pen of fate, and tell us not only what powers the person has, but how they have been employed. Animals who arrive slowly at maturity are the longest lived and of the noblest species. But men can't claim any natural superiority from the grandeur of longevity, for in this respect nature has not distinguished the male. Polygamy is another physical degradation, a custom that blasts every domestic virtue, and a plausible argument for it drawn from the well-attested fact that in the countries where polygamy is established, more females are born than males. Nature seems to be telling us something here, and apparently reasonable theories must capitulate to nature. And a further conclusion obviously presents itself. If polygamy is necessary, woman must be inferior to man and made for him. We know very little about the formation of the fetus in the womb, but it seems to me probable that an accidental physical cause may explain this phenomenon of the unbalanced birth ratio, proving it not to be a law of nature. I have met with some pertinent observations on the subject in Forster's Account of the Isles of the South Sea that will explain my meaning. After observing that of the two sexes amongst animals, the most vigorous and hottest constitution always prevails and produces its kind, he adds, "If this is applied to the inhabitants of Africa, it is evident that the men there, accustomed to polygamy, are enervated by the use of so many women, and therefore less vigorous. The women, on the contrary, are of a hotter constitution, not only on account of their more irritable nerves, more sensitive organization, and more lively fancy, but likewise because they are deprived in their matrimony of that share of physical love which, in a monogamous condition, would all be theirs, and thus, for the above reasons, the generality of children are born females. In the greater part of Europe, it has been proved by the most accurate lists of mortality that the proportion of men to women is nearly equal, or, if any difference takes place, the males born are more numerous, in the proportion of 105 to 100. We do not get from this any reason to think that polygamy is necessary. When a man seduces a woman, I think this should be called a left-handed marriage, and the man should be legally obliged to support the woman and her children unless adultery, a natural divorce, cancels the obligation. And this law should remain in force for as long as women's weakness causes the word seduction to be used as an excuse for their frailty and lack of principle. Indeed, for as long as they depend on man for subsistence instead of earning it by the use of their own hands or heads. But these women shouldn't be called wives in the full sense of that word. Otherwise the very purpose of marriage will be subverted, and all those endearing charities that flow from personal fidelity, and that sanctify the marriage tie, even where the spouses have neither love nor friendship for one another, would melt into selfishness. A woman who is faithful to the father of her children demands respect, and shouldn't be treated like a prostitute, though I readily grant that if it is necessary for a man and woman to live together in order to bring up their offspring, nature never intended any man to have more than one wife. Still, though I highly respect marriage as the foundation of almost every social virtue, I can't help feeling the most lively compassion for the unfortunate females who are broken off from society, and by one error torn from all those affections and relationships that improve the heart and mind. In many cases, it doesn't even deserve to be called an error, because many innocent girls become the dupes of a sincere, affectionate heart, and even more girls are, to put it vigorously, ruined before they know the difference between virtue and vice. Their education has prepared them to become infamous, and that is exactly what they do. Refuges and shelters are not the proper remedies for these abuses. What the world is short of is not charity, but justice. A woman who has lost her honour imagines that she can't fall any lower, and as for recovering her former status, that is impossible. No exertion can wash away this stain. Losing thus every motivation, and having no other means of support, she has prostitution as her only refuge, and her character is quickly depraved by circumstances over which the poor wretch has little power, unless she is uncommonly intelligent and high-spirited. Men are never driven by necessity to become prostitutes, whereas this happens to countless women. But this arises largely from the state of idleness in which women are educated, always taught to look up to man for maintenance, and to consider their persons as the proper payment for his exertions to support them. It is usually thought that when chastity is lost, everything worthy of respect in a woman is lost. Her character depends on one virtue, but the only passion fostered in her heart is love. Indeed, a woman's honour is not even made to depend on her will. In Richardson's famous novel, Clarissa tells Lovelace that by raping her, he has robbed her of her honour. What strange notions of honour and virtue the novelist must have! The condition of someone who could be degraded without his or her own consent is miserable beyond all names of misery. Most of life's evils arise from a desire for present enjoyment that gallops out of control. The obedience required of women in the marriage state comes under this description. A mind that is naturally weakened by depending on authority never exerts its own powers, so that the obedient wife is turned into a weak, idle mother. And even if this doesn't happen, there is a different kind of moral degradation inherent in this situation. When only negative virtues are cultivated, almost no thought is given to a future state of existence, i.e. to life after death. Writers on morals, especially when writing about women, have too often considered virtue in a very limited way, basing it solely on what will produce benefits in this life. Indeed, the stupendous structure that is virtue has been given an even more fragile base, in that the wayward, fluctuating feelings of men have been made the standard of virtue. It would almost provoke a smile of contempt if the vain absurdities of man did not strike us on all sides, to observe how eager men are to degrade the sex from whom they claim to receive the chief pleasure of life. And I have frequently, with full conviction, retorted Pope's sarcasm on them, or, to speak explicitly, it has appeared to me applicable to the whole human race. A love of pleasure or sway seems to divide mankind, and the husband who lords it in his little harem thinks only of his pleasure or his convenience. Some prudent men, or worn-out libertines, who marry so as to have a safe companion, are so driven by an intemperate love of pleasure that they seduce their own wives. Love, considered as an animal appetite, can't feed on itself for long without dying. This extinction in its own flame could be called the violent death of love. But a wife who has been made licentious in this way will probably try to fill the void left by the loss of her husband's attentions, because after being treated like a goddess, she won't settle for becoming merely an upper servant. She is still handsome, and instead of transferring her fondness to her children, she only dreams of enjoying the sunshine of life. Besides, many husbands are so lacking in sense and parental affection that during the first effervescence of voluptuous fondness, they refuse to let their wives breastfeed their children. Personal attachment is a fine basis for friendship, but when two young people marry, even virtuous ones, it might also be fine if there were some obstacle to their passion, if the memory of some prior attachment or disappointed affection made it, on one side at least, a match based on esteem rather than love. That would have them looking beyond the present moment, trying to make the whole of life worthwhile by forming plans to regulate a friendship which ought to last until death. Friendship is a serious affection, the most sublime of all affections, because it is based on principle and cemented by time. The very reverse may be said of love. In a great degree, love and friendship can't exist together in the same heart. Even when it's love for one person and friendship for someone else, they weaken or destroy each other. And for just one person, you can't have love and friendship at the same time. They have to take turns. The vain fears and foolish jealousies that are, when managed with wisdom or cunning, winds fanning the flame of love, are incompatible with the tender confidence and sincere respect of friendship. Love of the kind that glowing pen of genius has described doesn't exist anywhere on earth, except perhaps in the exalted, feverish imaginations that have sketched such dangerous pictures. Dangerous? Yes, because they not only provide a plausible excuse for the voluptuary who disguises sheer sensuality under a sentimental veil, but also spread insincerity and detract from the dignity of virtue. Virtue should have an appearance of seriousness, if not austerity, and to try to doll her up in the garb of pleasure, because virtue has been used as another name for pleasure, is to raise her up on a foundation of quicksand, a most underhand attempt to hasten her fall by apparent respect. Virtue and pleasure are not, in fact, as closely related in this life as some eloquent writers have tried to prove. Pleasure prepares the wreath and mixes the intoxicating cup, but the fruit that virtue gives is the reward for hard work, and when it is seen as it gradually ripens, all it provides is calm satisfaction. Indeed, appearing to be the result of the natural tendency of things, it is hardly noticed. Bread, the common food of life, and seldom thought of as a blessing, supports the constitution and preserves health. But feasts delight the heart of man, though disease and even death lurk in the cup that elevates the spirits, or the morsel that tickles the palate. The lively, heated imagination likewise paints the picture of love, as it paints every other picture, with the glowing colours stolen from the rainbow by a daring hand that is directed by a mind condemned to pant after unattainable perfection, always pursuing what it admits being a fleeting dream. An imagination of this vigorous cast can give existence to unsubstantial forms and stability to the shadowy daydreams which the mind naturally falls into when it is bored by reality. It can then depict love with heavenly charms, and dote on the grand ideal object. It can imagine a degree of mutual affection that will refine the soul, and make it get rid of every less noble affection and desire. with the couple in each other's arms, as though in a temple with its summit lost in the clouds, the world is to be shut out, and along with it every thought and wish that doesn't nurture pure affection and permanent virtue. Permanent virtue! Alas! Rousseau, good visionary! Your paradise would soon be violated by the entrance of some unexpected guest. Like Milton's, it would contain only angels and men sunk below the dignity of rational creatures. Happiness is not material. It cannot be seen or felt. Yet the eager pursuit of the good that everyone imagines for himself proclaims man to be the lord of this lower world, and to be a thinking creature whose role is not to be given happiness, but to acquire it. So those who complain of the delusions of passion forget that they are exclaiming against a strong proof of the immortality of the soul. I shall leave superior minds to correct themselves, and pay dearly for their experience. What I want to guard the female heart against, by getting women to exercise the understanding, is not strong, persevering passions, but romantic, wavering feelings. Daydreams that result from idleness, more often than from a lively imagination. Women seldom have sufficient serious employment to silence their feelings, with a round of little cares or vain pursuits frittering away all strength of mind and organs, it is natural for them to become only objects of sense. In short, the whole tenor of female education, the education of society, tends to make the best disposed of them romantic and inconstant, and the remainder vain and mean. In the present state of society, I am afraid, this evil can scarcely be remedied in the slightest degree. Should a more laudable ambition ever gain ground, women may be brought nearer to nature and reason, and become more virtuous and useful as they grow more worthy of respect. But I will venture to assert that their reason will never be strong enough to be able to regulate their conduct, while the first wish of the majority of mankind is to make an appearance in the world. The natural affections and the most useful virtues are sacrificed to this weak wish. Girls marry merely to better themselves, to borrow a significant common phrase, and they have such perfect power over their hearts that they don't allow themselves to fall in love until a wealthy man shows up. I'll say more about this in a later chapter. At present, I need only to drop a hint. From the same source comes the opinion that young girls ought to spend much of their time on needlework, though this contracts their faculties more than any other that could have been chosen for them, by confining their thoughts to their bodies. Men order their clothes to be made, and are done with the subject. Women make their own clothes, both the necessary and the ornamental, and are continually talking about them, and their thoughts follow their hands. What weakens the mind is not the making of necessaries, but the frippery of dress. When a woman in the lower rank of life makes her husband's and children's clothes, she is doing her duty. This is part of her business. But when women sew only so that they can dress better than they could otherwise afford, it is worse than sheer loss of time. For the poor to become virtuous, they must be employed, and women in the middle rank of life could employ them while they managed their families, instructed their children, and exercised their own minds. They could, but they don't, because they are aping the fashions of the nobility without having the nobility's means to have those fashions easily. Gardening, experimental science, and literature would provide them with subjects to think and talk about, subjects that would give some exercise to their understandings. French women are not so rigidly nailed to their chairs. Their conversation is often superficial, but it's not half as insipid as the conversation of those English women who spend their time making caps, bonnets, and the whole nonsense of trimmings, not to mention shopping, bargain hunting, etc. These practices are most degrading to decent, prudent women, because the motive of the practices is simply vanity. The wanton, who exercises her taste to make her personal luring, has something more in view. Women of quality seldom do any of the actual dressmaking. All they exercise is their taste. And because they think less about the finery, When the business of their toilet is over, they can put it behind them, and be at ease in a way that is usually not open to women who dress merely for the sake of dressing. In fact, the observation that the middle rank of society is the one in which talents thrive best doesn't apply to women. Women of the superior class do at least pick up a smattering of literature, and they converse more with men on general topics, so they acquire more knowledge than the women who ape their fashions and faults without sharing their advantages. As for virtue, using the word in a comprehensive sense, I have seen it mostly among the poor. Many poor women maintain their children by the sweat of their brow, and keep together families that the vices of the fathers would have scattered. But gentlewomen are too lazy to be actively virtuous, and are softened rather than refined by civilization. Indeed, the good sense I have met with among poor women, who have had few advantages of education, yet have acted heroically, has strongly confirmed my opinion that trivial activities have made women trivial. In tracing the causes that I think have degraded woman, I have confined myself to ones that universally act on the morals and manners of the whole sex. And it seems clear to me that they all arise from lack of understanding. Is this weakness of the faculties caused by the constitutions of women as such, or is it caused by their circumstances? Time alone can tell. I shan't lay any great stress on the example of a few women who were given a masculine education from which they acquired courage and resolution. I only contend that men who have been placed in similar situations have acquired a similar character. The women I have in mind include Sappho, Eloise, Catherine Macaulay, Catherine the Great of Russia, Madame Dion. These and many more can be counted as exceptions, and aren't all heroes and heroines exceptions to general rules? I want to see women neither as heroines nor as brutes, but as reasonable creatures. End of chapter 4.